This is Yehuda Kohen, Vision Movement, Vision Magazine, and you are listening to the Next Stage podcast. We're recording this here in Jerusalem, and with me for the first time in a long time is Vision organizer Aryeh Shapiro, who is back from Miluim, back from reserve duty, 5 months in the north of our country, in preparation for what will likely be a front of this war with Hezbollah. But right now, Aryeh is back. He's in Jerusalem, back learning in yeshiva full-time-ish. And Aryeh, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Yehuda. Glad to be back. It was definitely a meaningful 5 months in the north, but it's great to be back at home with my family and also back in the yeshiva and back to the Vision Movement.
All right. So a lot is happening. We've seen even in the last few days, especially in regards to the U.S.-Israel relationship, it appears that Prime Minister Netanyahu has recalled delegation headed by Tzachi Hanegbi and Ron Dermer to the White House, a delegation which had been sent or was going to be sent at the request of U.S. President Joe Biden. Netanyahu has canceled this delegation in response to the U.S. abstaining rather than vetoing a U.N. Security Council resolution, a U.N. Security Council resolution that has no teeth, but nevertheless one that our prime minister has decided was an anti-Israel resolution, enough so that the United States abstaining rather than vetoing was enough for him to call back his delegation. Now, at the same time, it's important to note that our defense minister, Gallant, is in Washington and is there with, you know, a shopping list of what weapons and equipment and munitions and planes we'd like from the U.S. to continue this war, which is already an unhealthy situation and something that's highly problematic to be taking place while our prime minister is recalling his delegation. And the U.S. administration has said openly that whatever conversation they would have had with Dermer and Hanegbi, they're going to be having with the opposition, with figures like Yair Lapid and even Benny Gantz, despite the fact that he's currently in the war cabinet.
Right. I think we're seeing now something that was clear in previous governments and under previous American administrations as well. We're really seeing the American machine, the interests of empire, honing in on figures that they see in the Israeli political system, not just as weak links and figures who are less likely to fight tooth and nail for Israeli interests, but people that really identify more with American civilization, with Western culture, as allies, as forces that they can use to advance their interests here in Israel. And just like under the Trump administration, we saw that Avigdor Lieberman was really working to advance and push Trump's partition plan. We've seen that the Biden administration has really taken under their wing both an opposition figure, Benny Gantz, former chief of staff of the IDF, who has joined the war cabinet in more of a unity government, as well as Yoav Gallant, the defense secretary, who is part of Netanyahu's Likud party, but also leans much more towards American interests.
Yeah, Gallant is not what we would consider an ideological Likudnik. You know, I think that one thing we should make clear, you know, when we talk about Israeli interests, whether or not this minister or that opposition figure is likely to push back against U.S. interests on behalf of Israeli interests, is that part of the problem is that most of our political leadership haven't defined for themselves in a serious way what Israeli interests are. I do believe that despite everything and despite all his flaws, Prime Minister Netanyahu has a developed conception of Israeli national interests. That includes, I believe, Israel retaining the lands won in the Six-Day War, especially the West Bank, Samaria, and Judea. Whereas I don't think a figure like Gantz or Lapid or even Gallant, for that matter, has an idea of what is in our interest, what is the Israeli national interest, other than having a close relationship with the United States. And that's a very dangerous position to be in.
Right. I mean, I think it really comes down to the current state of Zionism as an ideology, especially in the military. Rav Mike Feuer in his Jewish Story podcast talks a lot about this idea of survival Zionism. And to this day, most of the top brass in the IDF, their whole ideology is just Israeli survival. And when you don't see any unique role for Israel in history, any ideological bent for where Am Yisrael is supposed to be going, and the key is just to stay alive another few years, then obviously being best friends with the world superpower is your top priority, even if it's at the expense of things that have been important and even critical to your civilization for thousands of years.
Right, and so that's a problem, and I think it's even slightly worse than what you're expressing, because as Jonathan Pollard has mentioned, there's a culture in our army of high-level officers, when they retire, getting high-paying jobs as lobbyists for U.S. weapons companies in Israel, meaning that it's not just that we have no conception of our own interests other than a close relationship with the United States. There's a culture that's been developed at the highest levels of our military leadership where it's just in everybody's interest to keep that relationship going. And so many of the decision makers are either personally benefiting or are planning to personally benefit from the relationship or have close friends who are personally benefiting from it. Meaning it creates a culture which makes it very easy for everybody to kind of agree on the conclusion that what's best for Israel is a close relationship with the United States and to purchase their weapons rather than equip ourselves, etc.
Absolutely, and that is up to and including, especially Minister Benny Gantz, throughout his time as Chief of Staff of the IDF, actively shrunk and defunded the local Israeli weapons industry and even local Kitot Konanut, the armed teams that protect our yeshuvim along all of our borders, out of a sense that we would really let the American weapons and the American intelligence and the American Pax Americana take care of us. And we didn't need to be really acting to take care of ourselves.
Right. And we saw that the conventional wisdom among our military establishment over the last few decades was that we need to shrink our army, to actually make our army leaner, less tanks, less foot soldiers, more reliance on technology, and that, of course, has been disproven by the events of Simchat Torah, by Hamas's attack on October 7th, and the need to potentially fight on several fronts. And now that has led us to a very interesting political situation where the army is saying for the first time in a long time, we might actually need the Haredim to draft. Like, this might actually be something that the army needs. And this has led to something of a coalition crisis. I think it's being pushed now in an effort to destabilize Prime Minister Netanyahu's coalition, to bring down the government and bring Israel to elections. But nevertheless, this is a real issue in Israeli society that suddenly, while the army has been saying for years that Haredi enlistment is important in terms of spreading the burden equally among all citizens, and you know the health of our society, they were arguing that we didn't actually need them for manpower. But today the army is saying something different. Today we've come to the conclusion that we might actually need the Haredim to draft, and that's put Prime Minister Netanyahu in a very difficult situation where he's going to have to figure out a way to maneuver between his Haredi coalition partners, who are great politicians and are formidable political operatives, even for someone as seasoned as Netanyahu. But he's going to have to maneuver between what the army is saying, what the public seems to want, and what the Haredi politicians see themselves as being in government to fight for.
Absolutely. And I think, like you said, while there is a serious need for manpower, in many ways that need has been manufactured by the military establishment over the last few years, to the point where at the beginning of the war there was over 100% reserve enlistment because the army was so certain that we didn't need this manpower that they stopped reserve service for thousands, if not tens or hundreds of thousands, of our fit and trained reservists. So we're seeing that now this push to draft the Haredim is important, obviously, to discuss and to work through as a society. But the urgency and the suddenness of this issue is largely manufactured and obviously is comfortable for those in the Israeli political system who want to oust Netanyahu or at least topple his government with Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, and also to American interests who would love to nothing more than to see Ben-Gvir and Smotrich out of the government, especially as we start beginning to look at the day after in Gaza.
You're right. I think while the Haredi enlistment issue is an issue that we as a society need to return to in the near future, you know, during the war, at a time when Israel's fighting on several fronts, and at a time when the Americans seem to be actively trying to bring down our government and send us to elections, as certain American political figures, you know, like Chuck Schumer, have explicitly said, I think that we need to keep this coalition intact and avoid elections as long as we possibly can. Because I believe Prime Minister Netanyahu when he says that my successor will be squeezed by the Americans to create a two-state solution here, meaning that the American interest is that Israel give up the territories we won in 1967. They use the Palestinians, in my opinion, as a means to get Israel to give up that territory. But the U.S. has had a policy of forcing Israel to give, a bipartisan policy, by the way, of forcing Israel to give up that territory long before the Palestinians became the issue. Meaning it was only in the 1980s that the Americans, specifically President George H.W. Bush, basically strong-armed the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan to relinquish their claim on the West Bank in order to create space for the Palestinian national issue to be the issue. Yeah, I remember years ago when I worked for a member of Knesset, Aryeh Eldad, the son of Yisrael Eldad, who is one of the leaders of Lehi, you know, when he was interviewing me to decide whether or not to hire me, I said, there's one thing you need to understand about me. I really believe that if there was no Western involvement in our conflict, in our region, Israel would be able to end this conflict one way or another with all of our neighbors. But if there was not one Arab between the river and the sea, the Americans and the Europeans would try to find some other reason for us to give up our land. Because for them, it's not about Palestinians or anybody else. It's about making sure Israel doesn't have that land for a host of reasons we can get into. But that's what I believe the truth to be.
And it's nothing new, not just as old as the Bush administration. Even before there was a state, in 1946 and 47, the American administration sent Jews close to the American administration, members of the American administration, who they believed would have a stronger influence on the Israeli political system. They sent them to put pressure on Nachum Goldman, who was a member of the Histadrut and the Yishuv's pseudo-government, in order to get Nachum Goldman to push the rest of the Zionists to accept a partition plan even before 1948. And we've seen that in every generation almost. The Americans send their representatives, mostly liberal American Jews, to pressure the more westernized parts of the Israeli administration, the Israeli government, to accept partition in our land, often by threat or by force, to get the current government that's resisting American interests to fall. And it's not even an issue of left or right. Ben-Gurion and the labor Zionists, who were much further left than Yair Lapid or Benny Gantz today, were similarly resistant to much American pressure. And it was Davka the centrist Zionists that were a weak link for American oppression, just like Lapid and Gallagher.
Right, because they're the most westernized. Right, it's usually what we call the quote-unquote center, which basically means passively, or in some cases actively, accepting and championing Western values, Western social norms, a Western worldview, like a Western ideological paradigm, or the what we can call the ideological paradigm of liberalism, which is, of course, the superstructure of the capitalist system.
Right, and whether that be Dennis Ross putting pressure for the Americans on Paris, and especially on Rabin, up to and including Bush sending various delegates to pressure Ariel Sharon. We see time and time again these military elites, these high-ranking generals, pressured by their friends, their allies, and the American state and defense departments to make sacrifices, to give up parts of our land for this promise of an elusive peace with a Palestinian government or Palestinian parties that show no interest in advancing any kind of lasting peace. We see even with this UN resolution that just passed in the Security Council, the problem that Prime Minister Netanyahu has with the resolution is not that it's calling for a ceasefire, but that it does not tie the ceasefire to a release of the hostages. It calls on Israel to ceasefire and on Hamas to release the hostages, but it detaches the two issues in a way that Netanyahu knows will put actual pressure on Israel to stop shooting, to stop fighting in Gaza, but will put no effective pressure on Hamas and other parties in Gaza to actually release the hostages.
Right, meaning that we can't assume that the ceasefire that's imposed on us is null and void if we don't get the hostages back.
Exactly.
Right, well, it's interesting, you know, this year, the month of Ramadan coincides with Adar Bet. Right? I don't think the people of Israel are going to stop fighting in Adar Bet. Because that just happens to be a month where, from a back-end perspective, from a spiritual perspective, that's a month where we're really pretty strong. I remember even when I was a soldier in the army during the Second Intifada, I was injured at one point and wasn't able to serve in certain capacities, like frontline capacities. And I was used, you know, I was in the tatzpit and I was used for other things that I can do with a bad ankle, but I wasn't really, you know, at the checkpoints or in jeep patrols or on missions or anything like that. This is during my kav. And I remember once we entered the month of Adar, I could no longer accept that reality. Like even though my ankle wasn't fully healed, I just decided at that point, because we had entered the month of Adar, and because of the spiritual energy of Adar and what it means in terms of Israel at war, I went to my officer and demanded that they put me back into more frontline tafkidim, more frontline tasks, so that I can actualize that energy of the month of Adar on the battlefield, which is, you know, what our soldiers should be doing when the month of Adar comes around. And I just think it crucial on a deep level, important, that while the empire, the United States, is trying to pressure us specifically in the month of Adar to accept a ceasefire and stop the fighting when we could be spiritually at our strongest, it's very important that our prime minister resist that. On the other hand, I happen to think that a lot of the more what we can call humanitarian demands of the administration that just require us to be, you know, maybe a little more careful in regards to civilian casualties or making sure that aid reaches the people of Gaza. Not that I know logistically how Israel is meant to do that at this point, but I think those are things we should be interested in anyway, not because the Americans are demanding it of us, but because I think that our ability to effectively possess Gaza when all this is over, when we talk about the day after, for me, the day after requires that we possess Gaza. And I would ideally like to see the Jewish communities of Gush Katif that were destroyed in 2005 rebuilt, right? Like, and I think our ability to go back to Gaza and to possess Gaza and to live in Gaza again does at a certain point require us to be able to win over the hearts and minds of the Palestinians who live there. And I think making greater efforts on the humanitarian front would actually be beneficial if that is our aim. It's my aim. I don't know if it's our prime minister's aim. I think if it was, he'd be very quiet about it. I suspect it might be. I suspect that Netanyahu does see this as an opportunity for Israel to go back to Gaza and hold Gaza for no other reason, because there's no other way to protect the south of our country other than for Israel to possess Gaza. But I think that if that is our interest, we should want to do whatever possible. While we're in the process of destroying Hamas, we have to destroy Hamas, and obviously Hamas has positioned itself in such a way where the only way where we could actually neutralize it is to cut through thousands of civilians that we've seen already, that we know is going on. And as unfortunate as that might be, I just don't think we had an option. But now that we've established ourselves in most of the Strip, and it's really only Rafah that's really left for us to actively conquer, I think we can afford to shift our attention to humanitarian needs amongst Palestinian civilians, and to really have a plan for how we're going to win over hearts and minds so that our rule in Gaza won't be challenged by the non-Hamas population that's there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's an important discussion that the government and the military both need to start working on and thinking about, but it's absolutely not going to come through externally forced ceasefires or imposed conditions. Like I said, especially in the month of Adar, we know from the Purim story that Haman Davka hoped that his plan would succeed in Adar, because he knew that it was the month that Moshe Rabbeinu, our great leader, left the world. So he saw it as a time of weakness for us. But what he didn't realize, that it was also the same month that Moshe Rabbeinu was born, that his light was brought into the world and illuminated our ability. And as we're transitioning, not just in the current month of Adar, but also as we're transitioning in the next couple weeks into Nisan, into Pesach, into a month that Bezrat Hashem, all of our hostages will be freed from foreign bondage.
Right, Nisan being the month of Chirut, the month of freedom.
I think we're going to need to see the military pressure ramping up to get those hostages released, as at the same time maybe that in other parts of the Strip, the areas that we've cleared out largely of a Hamas presence, we can start working towards a more benevolent reign and control in those areas, really establishing ourselves as the sovereigns in all of our land, especially going towards the month of Iyar after that, where we really see in our generation the light of Am Yisrael's sovereignty returning to the world in all of its parts.
Right. I'm not sure if listeners fully appreciate the extent to which there are months on our calendar where it's good for Israel to fight wars versus months on our calendar where it's considered dangerous for Israel to fight wars. Like, for example, the month of Menachem Av, like in the summertime, it's not a great time to initiate a war for the Jewish people. I don't know who's listening to this podcast, what secrets I'm giving away here, but it's not a good time for Israel to fight wars. If we have to, we will. But the month of Adar is a great time for Israel to fight wars. This is like, if we want to utilize the spiritual power available to us to fight and win wars, Adar is a great time. And like you said, I think that for me, the greatest demonstration of strength is really not hard power, but soft power. And I think that the territory we've already conquered in the Strip, we should be setting up some kind of, even if temporary or even if ostensibly temporary, military or even civilian rule, where we are providing food and water and electricity and healthcare and maybe even education. You know, we complain about the education that Palestinians receive from UNRWA and from Hamas and from Fatah. Well, okay, great. Let's provide education. I think that that is the best way, in my opinion, to demonstrate strength and authority. It's really by providing for the needs of the people in a given territory. Nothing expresses your authority in any given territory like providing for the people in that territory that which they need.
Absolutely, and that may even lie at the root of American efforts and Western efforts to create this new port, this temporary floating port in Gaza. It's very possible that they're trying to fill the void of UNRWA to make sure that we don't, that we can't, to make sure that it's the Americans or the Saudis or the Jordanians that are providing for the Gazan people, and therefore continue to undermine any potential plans for Israel to establish our own sovereignty and control and responsibility in those territories.
Right, so therefore it would actually be politically advantageous for Israel to accept the American demands that call for humanitarian aid and more caution in regards to civilian casualties where possible. I think those are demands we should accept, not because they're American demands. We have to understand, Prime Minister Netanyahu is in a difficult position. Let's say the Americans are making, 17 demands on him. There are probably a good 3 or 4 he just can't do and won't do and shouldn't do, like talk about a Palestinian state, talk about Fatah taking over the Gaza region. Even letting in the Saudis or anybody else, I think, is highly problematic. I know not everybody agrees with me, but I think that would be highly problematic. I think the only solution the day after is Israel ruling Gaza, Gaza becoming part of Israel. But those things Netanyahu has to reject, he should reject, and he should reject them firmly. But clearly, in a situation where we are dependent because of our own previous mistakes, and also because of them creating a situation, a trap that we've fallen into, we are dependent on American arms right now while trying to fight a multi-front war. Therefore, it makes sense that the Prime Minister has to accept some of their demands. He can't reject all of them. Now, that means we have to be understanding, not just we at the Vision Movement, but you know, the type of people who vote for Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, have to understand that there are things the Prime Minister is going to have to give in on and things that he's not going to want to give in on. They should support him so he can be strong in standing up to the Americans on the issues of substance, on the issues that matter in terms of our national interest, in terms of our sovereignty in the land of Israel, including Gaza. But they should not challenge him when he does things like anything that they consider to be too soft against the Palestinian enemy. You know, they need to just calm down and give him space. Because again, the Americans know this game. The Americans have many times in the past destabilized an Israeli coalition, a nationalist Israeli coalition, a Likud-led Israeli coalition, by forcing the leader of the Likud, the prime minister, to do things that anger his coalition partners that are deeper in the national camp, right? Whether we've seen this with Prime Minister Shamir, we've seen this with Prime Minister Netanyahu in the late 1990s, they essentially force the Prime Minister to do things that anger the voters of some of his partners, cause him to look like he's selling out on the values that are supposed to unite the Likud with those parties. And it's a trap, I'm afraid, or I have been afraid during the course of this war, that Itamar Ben-Gvir was about to fall into, like destabilize a coalition over an issue that Netanyahu accepts the American demands on while resisting other American demands. I think it just makes sense that, unfortunately, in this situation, he's got to accept some of the demands. And I think just like the Haredi draft issue, which is being brought up right now in order to destabilize a coalition, and certainly, I mean, the timing is what the timing is, but it's been given the attention, you know, it's being highlighted, it's been centered in the national conversation to the extent that it has in order to create tensions in the coalition. I think some of the American demands have been meant to force Netanyahu to anger some coalition partners, like in the national religious camp. So we just need to be aware, those of us who are in the national religious camp and are close to the political leadership of that camp, need to understand ourselves and tell one another, just make it part of the conventional wisdom in our community that Netanyahu does need to make certain humanitarian concessions in order to continue the war against Hamas and create a situation where we retake Gaza.
Absolutely, and I think really the hostage negotiations are a central axis of that whole dynamic. We're seeing more and more massive protests in the street that get huge media attention and huge support from the American administration and the press, calling for replacing Netanyahu, for going straight to elections, because they claim that that's the only way to get a hostage deal, because Netanyahu is supposedly actively avoiding any kind of hostage deal. Obviously, part of Netanyahu's reticence to release hundreds of terrorists with blood on their hands for saving our hostages is not just the real fear that the last time we did that, one of the releasees was Yahya Sinwar, who's led Hamas through this war, but also an understanding that his partners in the coalition have threatened to leave the coalition if such an agreement is made. That's exactly what the Biden administration and what the former Kaplan protesters who have returned to the streets to protest again are hoping for. To the degree that they talk about it openly in WhatsApp groups and even in interviews on the news, they've stated that they have instructions from certain members in the Biden administration to continue pushing this narrative, this agenda against Netanyahu in hopes that Smotrich and Ben-Gvir will leave the coalition and they'll then be able to go to the elections that they're hoping for.
Right, and I think, you know, one thing I would add is Netanyahu knows that in order to release the maximum number of hostages possible, he has to drive down their price. And the way to drive down their price is not to behave with desperation or express a willingness to bring the hostages home at all costs. I understand and sympathize with the desperation of the hostage families. I get it. I'm glad I don't fully understand. I've never been in that position, and none of us should be. But one can only imagine the anguish that they're experiencing and the desperation they're experiencing. And for them, it's very clear that the only thing that matters is getting their loved one home at all cost, and their judgment is likely so clouded by the emotions they're experiencing that it's probably difficult for them to understand that the prime minister needs to behave publicly as if he doesn't care all that much about the hostages in order that Hamas doesn't demand a price too high for him to be able to pay. Right, that's just like 101 when it comes to negotiating, especially in West Asia, like especially in this part of the world in the Semitic region, that's just like how you negotiate. And I think Netanyahu's doing a relatively good job there. And I do believe that it's ultimately the military pressure that is going to bring back whatever hostages we're able to bring back. But yes, it's clear that the Americans are coordinating with the Kaplan Street protesters. And it was clear even when the war first started. And U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken sat in on our war cabinet meetings and then went directly to the Kaplan Street protesters to give them instructions to make sure that they link their struggle with that of the hostage families.
Yeah, I think we're really seeing that it's possible that the Americans have finally overplayed their hand. Like I mentioned, this is a strategy that they've been using for decades, since before there was a state of Israel. But in the last few weeks, we've really seen them go into overdrive, whether that's Schumer's public statements calling for Netanyahu to resign, to these protesters admitting to getting instructions from the White House. Israelis are waking up. A lot of Israelis are starting to for the first time in Israel's history, become aware of the serious influence and the serious games that America is playing in our political system, and they're beginning to resist.
Or at least recognize it as unhealthy and dangerous. I think that, you know, this was to a certain extent evident during the protests against judicial reform. During the judicial reform protests, it came out a few times that the Americans are behind this, and it's not only here. I mean, the truth is, this is just like pretty standard for the CIA playbook. They do this all over the world. Whenever the Americans want to destabilize or replace a regime in any country, this is essentially what they do. And I think they were doing it. I think that's a lot of what the anti-judicial reform protests were being driven by and perhaps funded by. But still, the only Israelis who were able to see that were those on the other side of that struggle, those who were with the government, those who supported judicial reform. But now the whole nation, for the most part, is unified in this war effort to not let Hamas do to us what they did on Simchat Torah ever again, to not let anyone do to us what they did on Simchat Torah ever again. Remember, this is the first time since attaining political independence in 1948 that the Jewish people have suffered a pogrom of this scale, right? This is the first time we've experienced such a traumatic reminder of what life was like without a state of Israel, right? In 75 years. And now the nation is unified behind regaining our deterrence and neutralizing those who attacked us. You know, for years, we left Hamas alone. We basically took the position that they're going to rule Gaza, nothing we can do about it. And it was largely because Hamas created a battlefield combining the tactics of an anti-colonial guerrilla struggle with the resources of a state. They created a battlefield that would force us to cut through tens of thousands of Gazan civilians to be able to neutralize them. And we weren't willing to do it. Before October 7th, we weren't willing to do it. Not Netanyahu, not Bennett, not Lapid, not Olmert. None of our national leaders were willing to do this. Maybe because they care about the civilian cost on the other side, or maybe because they care about how that would look on TV. But for whatever reason, they weren't willing to do it until Simchat Torah, until October 7th, when all bets were off, and we understood as a society, as a people, as a collective, that we need to neutralize Hamas no matter the price. Now, at a time where the nation is feeling this, and the national soul is open. I mean, the national soul is really open right now. The fact that you have celebrities, you know, publicly talking about celebrating Shabbat and hearing Zachor and encouraging others to go and celebrate Shabbat and hear Zachor, the fact that there seems to be such a desire. Remember, we, before this happened on Yom Kippur, we were fighting in the streets of Tel Aviv over Yom Kippur. Now the nation is somewhere else. The national soul is open. We want to know our purpose. We're ready to go to war. We're at war. We're fighting a war, not just for our survival, but for our identity. And the Americans are coming in, wanting to assume, that this is Netanyahu's war. That all they have to do is neutralize Netanyahu. They're not against the war. They're not against us destroying Hamas. I think the Americans want us to destroy Hamas because the Americans have identified Hamas. I mean, Chuck Schumer certainly did, but I think the Americans more broadly, I think the U.S. administration and previous administrations have identified Hamas as a barrier to their agenda in the region. So they're happy for us to take out Hamas, but I think that the fact that they're trying to push a conversation about the day after, they're trying to push a conversation about a Palestinian state. They're misjudging where the Israeli collective, not Netanyahu, where the Israeli collective is at. And I've even heard, you know, liberal Zionists who have been championing a two-state for decades on their podcasts begging the Biden administration to shut up about it. I think now is not the time. You are strengthening Netanyahu. This is Netanyahu's re-election campaign. He's doing terribly. Our prime minister is doing terribly in the polls. And maybe as a result of that, he has forced this issue of confrontation with the Americans into the center of the public conversation. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing for Israel. I think it's a good thing for him. I think it's a good thing for us. Definitely a good thing for the Vision Movement, because a lot of things that we've been talking about for years are now part of the mainstream conversation. But he's being accused of intentionally damaging the relationship in order to frame this as the issue, meaning go into elections with the issue being the U.S. empire trying to force something on Israel that he needs to lead us in resisting. I think that's the truth. I don't think it's something he's creating. I think that's always been the situation, and he's just lifted the curtain for us all to see, also because it helps him get reelected.
Right, and I think that's why a lot of the political analysis that I'm seeing that's talking about this split as a Michigan issue, mm-hmm. as something that Biden is playing up in order to win Muslim immigrants in Michigan, in order to win the upcoming election with Trump, completely misses the reality that the two-state solution and American interests in our region are not partisan, that it's not because of Somali refugees in Michigan that the American empire doesn't want us to be sovereign from the river to the sea. That's why the Trump administration before that also had a partition plan for our land that they tried to sell to us through Friedman and through Kushner. It's why the Bush administration advanced giving up Gaza in the first place. That's why from right to left of the American political spectrum, every administration stands behind a two-state solution because it's not a partisan issue. It's the American interests that we not be sovereign from the river to the sea.
Right. And I'll say something else. You know, I was just in the United States. I just spent 2 weeks in New York and in Miami. And I'll say that the U.S. Jewish community appears to be consciously more vulnerable than I've ever seen it before. There's a sense of insecurity, a sense of vulnerability, a sense of uncertainty, a sense that both their position in the United States, their sense of security in the United States, and the U.S.-Israel relationship are both maybe crumbling. That's, I think, a very healthy realization, and I hope that it leads the U.S. Jewish community or certain sectors of the U.S. Jewish community in the correct direction to adopt the correct line and come to the correct conclusions and to make the right moves. But unfortunately, one of the things that I have seen over and over again being expressed over and over again is the idea that we can fix it by voting Trump. And I think this could, the truth is, I do expect Donald Trump to win in November. And my expectation is that he's going to win. Joe Biden is not an exciting candidate for anyone. And Donald Trump is, for a lot of people in the United States, a very exciting and galvanizing figure. Now, I think this would be a disaster for Israel, because even what Netanyahu is doing now in terms of antagonizing the contradictions between the U.S. and Israel and leaning into a conflict with the United States, leaning into a confrontation with the Biden administration over a lot of the issues we've discussed, I don't think Netanyahu would be as quick to do that if Trump were in office. In truth, I think Netanyahu would be scared of Trump. I think Trump is a much scarier U.S. president than Joe Biden. And I think Netanyahu would be much more hesitant to behave the way he's behaving now. So it's honestly very much in our interest that Joe Biden remain president of the United States.
Right. I mean, we did see that Netanyahu did resist some of Trump's efforts when he was the president, to the point that there were leaked discussions of Trump ranting
FBB
and how furious he was that he was tricked or undermined by Netanyahu. But I think you're right. I think in the middle of a war with the coalition teetering the way it is due to this American pressure, it may be much harder for Netanyahu to resist Trump's savvy, right?
Right. Well, look, I think with Trump, we could expect Netanyahu to resist in the way he's traditionally resisted, which is by trying to outsmart the American president, lie to the American president, deceive the American president, and kind of outmaneuver him. That is the way Netanyahu outmaneuvered Trump the first time around and Obama by basically telling them one thing and doing another. I don't think he'd be able to get away with that now. And with Biden, Netanyahu is not exactly doing that. Netanyahu is actually confronting Biden frontally, which is a much healthier way to resist American pressure. But I just don't think Netanyahu has had that inner strength or self-confidence to behave in such a way. We saw such behavior with Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir and David Ben-Gurion at certain times. But Netanyahu appeared to be much more comfortable with a more like a snake-like approach to resisting the Americans, which is ugly and distasteful and sometimes even hard to recognize for what it is. But with Biden, he's actually resisting outwardly, loudly, publicly, leaning into the confrontation. It's very impressive. I actually have a lot more respect for Netanyahu than I once did. I've never voted for the man, but I am convinced that he has, for years, seen the primary antagonist in this chapter of Jewish history as being the U.S. empire and not, you know, Hamas or even Iran. And I think that all the moves he's made and all the games he's played has been about protecting Israel from the United States all this time.
Absolutely, and I think it's interesting, especially looking at Netanyahu and Bennett. Both of them have a background in America, spent time growing up in America. But Netanyahu, I think largely because of his father's career as a historian, has much more of an awareness of where we're living today and where the Americans lie in the meta-narrative of Jewish history. Whereas Bennett, who also understands and gets America as only someone who has lived around American civilization can, is much less aware, to the point that he was shocked how much, when he was prime minister, the Americans pushed him on a two-state solution.
Or just against Jewish building in the West Bank.
I think it really just comes down to an awareness and a consciousness of where we are in Jewish history, of what role we're playing in this generation in the Jewish story.
Right. I definitely think it's fair to say Netanyahu has an ideological compass. That ideological compass is revisionist Zionism. You could like it, you could leave it. I think it's the best we could do right now in a prime minister for the time being. I think that he has many flaws. I disagree with Prime Minister Netanyahu on many things, but I do believe he has an ideological compass and a conception of Israel's national interests beyond simply being friends with the Americans, being a protectorate of the empire. I think that he does have clear positions on many issues in terms of what's good for Israel. And therefore, I think he is the best leader to steer the ship at this moment in history. I think he's the best we can do. And I think it's very important that we keep him in office as long as possible.
Absolutely. And I will say, I do empathize, I guess, with a little bit of a grain of truth of Schumer's outburst, that there is a sense that we could do better, that we would like to see a Jewish leader who's more deeply connected to all of our values and not just this narrow strain of revisionist Zionism that you mentioned. And I think my response to that is that it's on us, that anyone who wants to see a different breed of Jewish leader needs to come and be a part of our story, that right. needs to make himself or make his students or his children into that kind of figure, talking about it from the halls of Western power, of the empire in Washington, D.C., is a cheap shot, and it doesn't cost a lot. But if you really want to see Jewish history moving in a different direction, in a more positive direction, come be a part of the story.
Right, and the best way, the best first step to really becoming part of the Jewish story is to take our Atid online leadership course. We just finished our winter cohort. We're about to begin our spring cohort. You can find the application online. If you go to visionmovement.org under programs, you'll find the Atid online leadership course. You can apply there. I strongly encourage you to do it. Last cohort was amazing. I'm excited for this upcoming cohort, and it's a great way to really begin the intellectual journey of becoming an active participant in Jewish history and formulating what the goals of Jewish history are right now in this chapter. Meaning that's really important, not what Iran's agenda or China's agenda or America's agenda is, but what is our agenda. And the more we're able to formulate for ourselves what our national interests are, what our national agenda is, the better we'll be able to participate in this chapter of history, not as a chess piece on the board, but as a player. And that's really what I urge all of you to do. So any listener who's interested, check out visionmovement.org, go to programs, go to the ATEED online leadership course, and apply today.
The ATEED course is how I got where I am today. I myself was an undergrad in Washington, D.C., playing around and dreaming of walking the halls of American power to advance Israeli interests, to support Israel, to be an ally of Israel. And when, during my semester abroad, I got connected to the Vision Movement and to the ATEED program, it put me on the path that brought me to Israel, to the IDF, and to being an active member in the Vision Movement.
And Mechon Meir.
In Mechon Meir. And to where I am now on these issues, on advancing Jewish history, the way that I think we need to, and not the way Western academia or even Zionist Jewish day schools in America
or APEC
push us to.
Right. Aryeh is actually a great poster boy for the ATEED program. And also, I urge all of our listeners who enjoy this podcast to support us on Patreon. You go to patreon.com/visionmovement. You can find not only the episodes of this podcast and my podcast on the weekly Parsha, but also a lot of exclusive content that you only get if you're part of our Patreon community. So I urge listeners to go there. And of course, your support helps keep this podcast on air and independent so that we bring you views like the views we're bringing you without having to worry about corporate sponsors and their feelings. So anyway, Aryeh, welcome back to Civilian Life. Glad to have you on the podcast. It was a good conversation. I think we've said a lot for now. This is clearly going to be an episode that focuses on the U.S.-Israel relationship in crisis in the midst of this war. And if listeners are interested in checking out the show notes for this episode, you can go to visionmag.org/thenextstage118.